Today is February 16th.
What?
16th, 2017, is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services. Today is again a continuation of the public hearing on House Bill 5026. We're still in the Health Services Division, Systems Division. We hope to wrap that up and move into the Health Policy and Analytics section. So with that, I think we've only got about three more slides left. So please.
Good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. Again, I'm Mike Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator for the Oregon Health Authority. So I'm here to talk about the last slide regarding behavioral health at this point, and that is the proposed legislation. And this has to do with juvenile fitness to proceed. This is equivalent to the process that adults go through for when they're unable to aid and assist in their own defense. And this, we're having a similar issue, although it's not quite to the magnitude as the adult problem, but there are kids that are being sent to the secure adolescent inpatient program at the farm home when they don't need that level of care. The courts are sending them there, and so they'll be sitting in that level of care when they don't really need that psychiatric care that program offers. And that creates problems as far as access for other kids who need that level of service. It's a limited service. This legislation would provide that link with the community mental health program, that they would have an interaction with the courts to identify what is the proper level of care that child needs to be in prior to a decision being made to send them to possibly to the secure adolescent inpatient program. So this would hopefully get kids to the right level of care as opposed to that higher level of care. And this has actually a projected savings, if we're able to do this, of $438,948.
The questions will come later, real quick.
Good morning. I'm Kate Nass, with the Deputy Director of Finance with the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm going to just talk a little bit about some policy option packages that are included in the governor's budget for the Health Systems Division. I'll go to the bottom one just because we just talked about this one. This is the juvenile fitness to proceed that's tied to the legislative concept that Mike just went through. And so there is a POP that actually pulls the $468,000 that you just talked about out of the Health Systems Division budget. So should that legislation go forward, we would have that savings. Moving up to the first one, the hepatitis C treatment expansion, we had a lengthy conversation with Dr. Rickards a couple of days ago about hepatitis C, the pricing of it, whatnot. This actually is the POP that expands the coverage so that we can start treating those that are in stage two. So currently we treat patient or members of the health plan that are in stage three or four, and this moves that to an earlier stage. So there is a general fund impact of about $32 million on that is added to the health systems budget. And the last one I'll cover is...
Before you move to the next one, what's the long-term impact of treating in stage two?
Well, hopefully all sorts of savings and more acute...
All sorts of savings sounds good.
In better life.
Can we narrow that down a little bit?
I would love to see, lower cost of care in the future that these members are not receiving higher services or higher cost needs in the future. Lori, do you want to talk a little bit about the longer term impact from a patient standpoint? Do you know that?
Sure, I can speak briefly, and then Jim can also come up. So good morning. I'm Lori Coyner, State Medicaid Director, Oregon Health Authority. So these long-acting antivirals cure hepatitis C. So what you would expect is if a person goes down the path of untreated hepatitis C, they are going to be quite expensive in terms of treatment. And so the long term, when you talk long term, once we go through kind of this initial expense to treat them, they are cured. And the expectation is that they will be a much lower cost because they will no longer have that chronic disease. Is that helpful?
It is. Senator Sarah,
go ahead if you want to ask me.
I was just going to, like, in a 10-year period, does it bend the cost curve? Or, I mean, so kind of like, what is that impact, you know, long term?
I don't have the analysis, and let me turn to Jim and see if they have we done anything. You want to?
Good morning. Jim Rickards, Chief Medical Officer, OHA. Treating at stage 2 disease, it has several benefits. One, for the individual, it decreases their own morbidity and mortality from progressing to an advanced stage of disease. When individuals reach stage 3 and 4 disease, they're at increased risk of liver cancer, liver failure, needing a liver transplant. Studies vary in terms of the lifetime costs of treating someone with hepatitis C that's chronically infected. They range from about $69,000 to over $120,000 per year, depending on if that individual goes on to need a liver transplant or liver cancer. You know, so depending on the individual and how their disease progresses, you know, the savings could vary. Someone could have hepatitis C chronically and not go on to those more severe conditions, but that would be about the range of savings. So.
Okay.
So the $32 million is a number that's been going down progressively because the price of these drugs has been going down. Do we think there's a chance, a reasonable chance, it will go even lower?
Yeah, typically when we negotiate back those supplemental rebates, it's for a year. So, you know, that's the pricing we have for 1 year, basically. But every year as new drugs come to market and we get new supplemental rebate contracts, that price will continue to come down, I believe. So that's what we've seen. We've seen it, you know, decrease by about half over the last 2 to 3 years as more drugs have entered the market. So.
Yes, Senator Winters.
Just a question. In addition to the negotiation of the contract, is it because there's more drugs coming into the market, so there's more competition in the market, so pricing is going down? And my second question, is there any way, because I think it's important to capture what future cost went to the system if you don't do this? I know there's so many variables that are involved, but just like everything else, we look at what happens if you don't do it, and what does it cost. Is there some way of teasing out some of those variables?
Yeah, I believe that's addressed in the POP in more detail to some effect.
Excuse me. Yes, you're right. We do talk a little bit about the variables, but or the potential savings. But the problem is to pinpoint the exact dollar savings is rough. So I can come back with kind of a little bit more of a robust discussion or paragraph or two about what that looks like, helpful. If that's helpful.
That would be very helpful because, you know, particularly when we're looking at, you know, the morbidity rates, we're looking at, you know, also and that over time, it's the same question we've always had with respect to, does prevention really work? You know, is, you know, providing dollars at the front end or wherever in this path that it works? And so as much as we can kind of pinpoint, yes, if we do this, this saves this. So I'd appreciate it, actually, whatever you can do.
We'll come back with a little bit more of a robust paragraph on that.
Yeah. Okay.
And then now moving on to the second bullet there, where we're talking about the Cover All Kids expansion, expanding coverage of the Oregon Health Plan to children ages up to age 18 who would otherwise qualify for the Oregon Health Plan except for the fact of the federal citizenship documentation requirement. So that's projected to cover about up to about 15,000 children in the 17-19 biennium and has a general fund cost of about $55 million, and that's included in the Health System Division budget as well.
Yeah, Representative Bueller.
What would prevent children who don't qualify in other states due to their immigration status from coming to Oregon getting health services?
Representative Bueller, members of the committee, I'm not quite certain. I don't.
Is that a no?
I haven't.
Yes?
I'm sorry.
Is that a no or yes?
We don't. There's nothing preventing them from moving here. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Oregon could be a magnet for other states to have similar kids to come here for their health services?
Potentially. I mean, I think.
Have you done an analysis of how much that potentially could cost the general fund?
No, we have not done a migration, like an immigration kind of analysis, no.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward.
The folks from the OHA should correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection that this concern was raised in the early 90s when we were implementing the Oregon Health Plan in the first place, and we did not see a substantial in-migration because of the broadening of the Oregon Health Plan at that point. There was an analogous concern at that point, Representative Buehler. You're right, nothing, it's something we need to be attentive to, but we did not see that concern come to fruition at that point in time. And I think given that these kids are part of large families, it may be harder to uproot a whole family. Not impossible, but harder to uproot a whole family.
Yeah, Representative Buehler.
Do you know how many FQHCs there are in the state of Oregon?
I have a number floating around in my head, but I'm worried it's wrong. So can I get back to you, Representative Buehler?
I think there's
Ms. Ames.
I don't know.
I think there's about 40 or more. My understanding is that these children could get their care at these FQHCs in Oregon right now, which is federal dollars. Correct?
Representative Buehler, yes, they do get primary care, or if the FQHC offers dental care or different types of care at the FQHC. The problem is if something is more robust or need additional services or service that's not at an FQHC, this would provide that coverage for the family.
Please.
But most important preventive health care for children is mostly outpatient that could be delivered in FQHC. Most of children's health care is outpatient, correct?
Representative Buehler and members of the committee, you are right that most of the health care that preventive health care can occur in a primary care setting, so like an FQHC. The advantage of this is, as Kate mentioned, for kids who require special services, hospitalizations, or other kinds of services, that they would then have the health care coverage for those, or emergency department visits, that kind of thing as well.
Senator Winters.
That begs the question of when you put the budget together, this package, how closely have you worked with the federal qualified centers in order to craft this budget? Because Representative Buehler brings up a very good point. That is 100% versus where we're talking about that we have to make some contribution. And so I need to know, in coming up with the figures, did you take that in consideration of the number of individuals that could actually be in that system?
Thanks, co-chairs, members of the committee, and Senator Winters and Representative Buehler. My name is Leslie Clement, for the record, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. The distinct two things. One, to your point, yes, we've been working with the FQHCs, the federally qualified health centers, and in fact have, based on last year's budget, worked with them to develop some grants to start working on some outreach and making sure they get services. The distinction between this budget proposal and what we're doing now and what's happening with services provided to those kids is really, this proposal is to give them an insurance package, right? The FQHCs provide only outpatient care, to Lori's point. They don't provide specialty care. They don't provide inpatient services. And this particular budget package is intended to align with a similar package that's provided to currently Medicaid-eligible kids. So the distinction is, one is access to services, maybe in an ad hoc manner. The other is actually through a covered benefit package. Does that help? That's the difference. It's not to say they don't have access to certain services today. It's the difference between having insurance and not having insurance.
And this is a policy we will, continue to have a more robust discussion down the road. So in the frame of kind of moving the conversation forward, we might want to limit our conversations to that other time. But Representative Hayden.
Very quickly, thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Could you just tell me whether if you get the expanded population for these kids and you get a piece of paper that says they have insurance, will they then stay on open card or will they be assigned to a CCO?
Representative Hayden and members of the committee, they would be assigned a CCO just like all the other kids. They wouldn't be held in fee-for-service.
Please.
And are you concerned at all with the access actually being negatively impacting? We see a very good example of their mothers, the pregnant women that do have the insurance, and those assigned to a federally qualified health center have access rates of 5+ times that they do that are in our system or the Oregon Health Plan, not inside the federally qualified health systems. And so we see a significant drop of those being provided services. Are you concerned that there may be a negative impact to these children once you give them a piece of paper that says they have insurance and they no longer access the federally qualified health centers, where we see with other populations that population receives a significant higher access to care?
Yeah. Chair Representative Hayden, I would say that the utilization experience that this budget is built on, this POP is built on, is based on the current utilization of our current Medicaid-enrolled children. And children typically in our program have better access than adults. Actually, adults just have a harder time accessing services. So we would expect that they wouldn't experience a similar barrier to, like, the example you gave in terms of pregnant women. That would be an improved utilization and improved access.
Yeah. Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward.
Can I just clarify something, and correct me again if I'm wrong, but these kids could still and would probably still continue to get their care at the FQHCs. Yeah. The FQHCs serve Medicaid patients. They serve undocumented kids. They serve adults. Simply because they got on OHP would not encourage them to move off out of the FQHC system. They would most likely stay there because people value that continuity of care, and most of the FQHCs are set up to work well with these families. And so I would not expect them to change where they're getting their care under these contexts at all. I mean, and if they did, most of the pediatric practices in this state are patient-centered primary care home certified, level 3 certified, which means that they get that kind of wraparound service that we know is associated with significant cost savings, as documented by the reports that we were talking about yesterday. So they would continue in a good location.
Here, Representative Bueller.
So that means that we would pay for them through a CCO, and the federal government paid for them through the FQHC.
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, it's not a double dip situation, so they couldn't look to the federal government at the same time they're looking to us for payment for those services.
And
it's a match.
Well, they don't.
Representative Bueller, do you want?
They don't pay when they go to a FQHC.
Right. They pay
according to their ability to pay.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So.
Exactly.
But we taxpayers are paying for the services they access at a FQHC that they can't pay in full because of their income status. So mm-hmm. we would pay to the CCO through our Oregon taxes and our federal taxes, and pay through our federal taxes to the FQHC. So we're going to be paying twice as taxpayers.
I'm not sure. I I understand what you're saying. All I'm saying is it wouldn't be a duplicate payment of the actual amount that FQHCs get, or they get some grants from the federal government.
I can explain. Representative Bueller and members of the committee, FQHCs get what we call a wraparound payment from the federal government, and that wraparound payment is to cover those people that they see that can't pay. So Medicaid pays for an individual to go to the FQHC, there's an added-on federal wrap payment that's required. And the idea behind that, the reason that they are given those extra payments is to make them whole for the uncompensated care that they provide in their facility.
Okay, and we'll go into this a little bit further later on. So I appreciate the patience.
Members of the committee, I've been asked to talk about, I think in continuation to what we've been discussing a little bit, is some potential program reduction levers that and the consideration around those potential levers that you may be thinking about as you move forward in budget discussions. And before I kind of walk through the slide, I do want to kind of step back and talk about where we were in 2012. In 2012, that's when we received the waiver that we have started CCOs and the coordinated care model. And during that time, we also agreed with CMS to hold costs down so that our rate of growth was not greater than 3.4% per year. We did make good on that. I want to be very clear that the agency and the CCOs have held to that 3.4% rate of growth, and that as reflected in our budget across that time. And one of the pieces that we talked about a lot was that the traditional levers are to cut people. If you need to have cost savings, or cut people, cut benefits, or cut provider rates, and that we were really offering a fourth path, which was more coordinated care and doing the things that we have set out to do, such as reducing emergency department visits, reducing hospitalizations, and expensive uncoordinated care. And we're still committed to that model moving forward. However, due to a number of different reasons, we are facing a budget shortfall, and so I'm going to talk about some of the possibilities that could be used, or reviewing these old levers again, and what some of the implications are around those. So the first on the slide there is to reduce people or reduce enrollment. This would require reopening our waiver that was just approved. And for some populations, we have what are called maintenance of effort requirements. So for example, kids under the CHIP program have maintenance of effort, and we can't cut those until 2019. So there are some, for specific populations, limitations in terms of where you could do reductions in enrollment. There is the possibility to reduce the ACA or expansion adults, as well as those women that are enrolled in the breast and cervical cancer program. Now, one of the pieces that I will mention, there's flexibility to reduce the ACA adults, but you have to remember that right now, they during the next biennium, they'll be receiving 94% federal match. So when you look at our total dollar amount, by reducing that enrollment, you don't get, you get more modest savings because of the large federal investment. The second option is to look at decreasing benefits. Again, this would require reopening our waiver with CMS. And we have been at the same line on the prioritized list of services since 2011. And it would require moving up that line. That requires, even if we didn't open up the waiver, approval by CMS. And in our waiver, we have the... So for the expansion adults, we were required to provide what's called an essential benefit, which is outlined in the ACA. We have a waiver that allows our prioritized list, you know, the CMS has been assured that our prioritized list encompasses the essential benefit. And so, ACA members have the same package as other Oregon Health Plan members, all receiving those services that are above the line of the prioritized list. So if we move the prioritized list, we'd have to assure and kept the ACA in, you'd have to assure that you still meet essential benefits, and we'd have to receive approval from CMS. In speaking with staff, there have been times where we, in history since 1994, where the legislature has asked to move up the list and CMS has declined that request, and there have been times when it was allowed. So,
and is there a differentiation between approval and disapproval for moving that line? Was there any analysis into why or why not we got approval from CMS under the various circumstances?
Representative Rayfield and members of the committee, I believe that CMS looks at what services are included that they consider essential for Medicaid, and so that would be really what determines whether they allow us to move the line up or not.
So in theory, if we move the line in consistent with what was required under the ACA, it would, in theory, get approval from CMS.
We may get approval. I can't speak for that.
Yeah. And how long does that process generally take?
How long?
Yeah, I mean, what does that look like? I mean, yeah, because I mean, the waiver process, right? Like, took quite a while, right?
Well, so the only reason I left is typically when we start conversations with CMS, it's not speedy, and with the new administration coming in, it's just going to take a little while before people learn background and enough information to really make decisions. So CMS is kind of on a hold for decisions. I imagine it would take some months. I don't have an estimate. I could call and ask. If we have to reopen the waiver, then that a waiver amendment typically takes 4 to 6 months.
Yeah, just from a planning standpoint, you know, it's kind of interesting. Do you have a question? Co-Chair Steiner-Herbert?
Yeah, two questions, if I might, Mr. Chair.
Please.
First is, if you were to match up our prioritized list above the line and the essential benefits, would the essential benefit, like, if we were to only have the essential benefits, would it take out some services that are much higher on the list, much more value, cost-effective from our perspective as a state than ones that are on this? I'm not explaining this well, but would it be a direct, like, go up this line to get to the essential benefits, or would we be picking and choosing from among the 500 items or whatever there are right now on the list?
Senator Steiner-Hayward, members of the committee, I believe it's the latter, where we are going to have benefits tucked in. An example, low back pain. We provide ancillary services for low back pain that are not listed in the ACA as essential. And so that would be an example of one where, you may have to pick and choose, which by statute, we don't pick and choose on the prioritized list. So.
Right. And then the other question is, do we run any risk by reopening our waiver that they could cancel it altogether?
Senator Steiner-Hayward and members of the committee, yes. Once you open a waiver for an amendment, they typically CMS doesn't do this, but they have the right to then look at every other policy that you have in that waiver. So that's the risk.
Lovely. Okay.
Contractually, that doesn't make any sense, but it's the federal government.
It's the federal government, so they don't expect consistency.
Please continue.
Okay.
Have to look and see what's.
The other option is to reduce capitation rates for CCOs. Again, our capitation rate methodology must be approved by CMS, we are required by the managed care rule and other rules to have actuarially sound rates and follow the rate setting process that's outlined in the managed care rule. So we would have to, now that doesn't require us to open up the waiver. What we do is we compute rates on an annual basis, and those are part of our annual contract. And so, but we would have to get CMS approval. Any questions on that? And then reducing fee-for-service rates for providers, again, we'd need CMS approval. I think the difficulty here is we recognize that access is an issue for some of our fee-for-service members, and so the issue that you can intensify by reducing fee-for-service provider rates is limiting access further, since providers won't you'll cut the reduce the group of providers willing to take OHP open card. The last is making administrative reductions within the Oregon Health Authority is the another option.
Maybe I can butt in.
Ms. Ames.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, maybe it would be helpful to have some context that we specifically asked the agency if they would come in with this discussion about sort of where are your levers? What do you even control that we might be able to reduce in this budget environment? Obviously, they have their reduction list with a lot more detail, but we thought this kind of overview would be helpful to get people thinking about. It's not that easy to cut this budget in some ways, and this gives a little bit of a framework to start that discussion.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for that, Linda. This is really high level. It's just to give you the committee to start thinking, and certainly if you have details and want more information, we're able to provide that. Okay.
Good morning, I'm Janelle Evans, Budget Director for the Oregon Health Authority. This is our last slide for the Health System Division, and it's to run through some of the reduction options that are in the governor's budget. The largest reduction that the governor's budget includes is holding our coordinated care organization inflation to zero. When we built the budget, with 3.4% per year inflation growth. This would save $94 million, cutting that. Of general funds. The governor's budget also reduces inflation growth in the fee-for-service realm, saving $10 million of general funds. The next one is a 1% reduction in the administrative portion of our coordinated care organization's costs. They currently get approximately 8% administrative portion of their capitation rate, and this would reduce it to 7. We also have administrative reductions for the Oregon Health Authority included. In the Health System Division, this would save $7 million of general funds. And the last one is our preferred drug list for mental health. We currently have a voluntary preferred drug list, and this would make it an enforceable preferred drug list.
Just a quick question on the administrative reduction for OHS. Is 5 to 10% up there, and then there's only one 6.9 million. So I was wondering if that was 5 or 10.
It was 5 to 10% over the whole agency. It's 5%, and so we left it so that it would be consistent for as we talk about each one. It's basically a 5% reduction across all of our administration, plus a 30% reduction in our travel budgets. And additional vacancy savings also.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. All right, are there any questions? Okay, thank you. So we'll go ahead and move on to health policy and analytics and bring up Director Clements again.
Good morning. Again, for the record, Leslie Clement, Director of Health Policy and Analytics. We're going to pivot to the Health Policy and Analytics Division. I'm going to give you an overview of the purpose of the division, some of the goals that we have, share our organizational chart. You're familiar now with most of the people that are in that division because of the presentations. I'll talk to you a little bit about what each of the areas does. I'll talk to you about some of the challenges. I'm going to have Janelle cover the budget slide. I'm going to ask Susan Otter to come up and go through the Office of Health Information Technology. I can't speak. slides, and we'll see how far we get today. With that, I'll start. So the purpose of the division is really to provide agency-wide policy development. Specifically staff the Oregon Health Policy Board, and a lot of our work takes place in that space. We also provide clinical leadership agency-wide. So under Jim Rickards as the chief medical officer, he leads a clinical leadership team that includes the Medicaid medical director, the behavioral health director, and the oral health director. He also oversees the Health Evidence Review Commission, and we provide the Medicaid policy leadership. Some of the goals, and I won't list them all, but hopefully I'll capture the high-level ones. Health system transformation has been on our radar for a long time. It started back in, 2009. I want to comment, too, that the leadership team that is in this division has all been around less than 5 years. So, our history is, our institutional knowledge is a little limited. But we've relied on those documents and said, how are we doing? We're working with the Health Policy Board. We went on a CCO listening tour this last year. And we are also in the middle of updating the Action Plan for Health, which is a document that was first developed in 2009. It was published in 2010, and we're looking at that right now.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
I'd like for the record, because you said transformation was 2009. That's actually when we actually passed. But the actual work leading up to it, I need to give a shout-out to some people. Because they were very very much involved with that, and they're not with us right now. And that's Senator Bates, Senator Westland, and there's others, and Senator Cruz, myself, and others who've been in this building. And it actually started with Governor Kitzhaber back in 2003. So I just need to put that on the record, because the work preceding 2009 would not have occurred if those individuals were not involved. So,
great. Thank you. As also another big goal for last year was getting this 1115 demonstration waiver approved. I would say we have addressing rising pharmacy costs. You've heard a lot about that. That is more than an 18-month objective. We expect to be working on that for a long time. We also are leading the behavioral health policy work. One of the major objectives was to, after 3 years of negotiating with the U.S. Department of Justice, to agree upon what we now call the Oregon Performance Plan. It's a three-year agreement. It's not a consent decree, which is a major victory for Oregon. Rather, it's just an agreement, and it's aspirational to really address the needs of individuals with adults with serious and persistent mental illness. We can go into that in deeper detail. And then the Behavioral Health Collaborative was a key goal and objective to stand up and engage stakeholders in a robust discussion about how we can really accelerate our progress in behavioral health system in Oregon. And my understanding is we'll be back on Monday and hopefully have a more robust discussion about the Behavioral Health Collaborative when Director Saxon is here. We also hired a dental director a couple years ago, and over the last year really wanted to, again, breathe new life into our oral health strategic planning. And so there were a number of products that we expected to deliver. One is an oral health toolkit, and the other one was an environmental scan. A major initiative was a multi-payer primary care payment reform collaborative. This came out of Senate Bill 231. We also welcome the opportunity for the Comprehensive Primary Care Plus program. And so there was major effort in terms of landing the objectives around those, both the legislation and the opportunity at the federal level. We also, our shop also takes responsibility for responding to a lot of legislative directions that come from this body. We contracted for an emergency boarding study. You'll hear about that. We also contracted for the healthcare financing study with RAND. We followed through with a primary care spending report that really tells all of us how much money our CCOs, commercial payers, PEB and OIP carriers are spending in primary care and in what form. And then also our objective was to build on the work of the direction around Senate Bill 440. So there was a strategic plan for data collection that was accomplished, and then the committee itself will be stood up in the next month or so. The summary of the division programs.
Oh, please.
I'm sorry. Sure. Director Clemens, what's the timeline for getting that 440 committee actually having a usable product for all the insurance companies? Because that would be a big cost savings for everybody to have standardized metrics.
Yeah. Co-chair, member of the committee. The committee is supposed to be in place this month. The letters are going to be sent out from the governor's office shortly. They want to make sure that we have a diverse membership, so we have most of those seats identified. We have a couple of extras that we just want to make sure that we've got the racial, ethnic diversity and the consumer voice on those committees. So I would say we're a little behind where we need to be. And then over the next year, we would expect to produce a product that would identify focus metrics that would align across all the payers. But it'll probably be at least a year.
Okay. Since it was my bill, I'd appreciate being kept apprised. Thank you.
Absolutely. Again, this is simply a list or summary of the programs we are responsible for. We have the state Medicaid authority. We're responsible for the waiver. And I would say we're responsible for more than just the waiver, but the entire policies surrounding the Medicaid program. I mentioned the clinical leadership, the prioritized list, our patient-centered primary care program. This is administering this program, too, not just developing policy around it. A quality improvement and system innovation support. This is work that largely takes place in our transformation center. Staff to the policy board. We do data analytics that comprises a variety of work, including the all-payer, all-claims database, the metrics work that happens with the CCOs, a lot of the reports that you receive, the legislative quarterly reports. We're doing strategic development and coordination around health information technology. You'll hear more about that from Susan Otter. And then finally, we're also in our division responsible for the oversight of the PEB and OEB boards. And the administrator of that program, Kathy Loretz, will be doing a separate budget presentation to this committee.
Thank you.
here's our simple high-level org chart. You can see that Lori Koiner is our state Medicaid director. That means she is the single point of accountability as the federal government looks to Oregon's Medicaid program, responsible for the demonstration waivers, responsible for home and community-based waivers, the state plan. State plan is a contract between the federal government and the state that's all those federal regulation, the waiver, are the pieces that we're saying we would like permission to waive that to test new models of care. Then we have a health policy director, David Simnett, oversees that. That's the really primarily the staffing of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Then we have the clinical services under direction of Dr. Jim Rickards, our analytics director, John Collins. He's not able to be here with us today, but he's our data guru. Susan Otter leads the Office of Health Information Technology, and as I mentioned, Kathy Lawrence oversees the PEB and OEB boards. So I'm going to turn it to Janelle now to review our budget.
So we have a couple more of our healthy budget bagels. The Health Policy and Analytics Division, the total budget is just over $150 million. 63% of that budget is for the Office of Health Information Technology, 26% is for the Office of Health Policy, and 9% for the Office of Health Analytics, and 2% for business support functions. And then breaking down the division division's budget by fund type, 63% of their budget is federal funds. This is primarily Medicaid. Also supporting in there is the Medicaid funds for the health information technology budget. 13% is other funds, which is primarily tied to the POP for the Office of Health Information Technology for the common credentialing fee. And then 20% of the budget is general funds.
Great, thank you. Back to the Medicaid program. So I'm assuming that Lori has given you a great deal of information in the last couple days about the Medicaid program. This slide is here, but I don't want to be redundant. If you have any particular questions, I'd like to just pause rather than repeat what you've already heard through other conversations. So I'm glad to take questions. I'm also glad to invite Lori up.
Senator Winters.
I'm just going through, and maybe I'm ahead, and it's on the summary piece. And I just found it rather fascinating and interesting, and you can tell me, because it says in-person listening sessions were held throughout the state. Was the listening to, were you listening, or were they listening? Who was listening?
Oh, okay. I think I'm going to get to that a little bit further down.
Further down?
Yeah, but we can go to that if you feel like the Medicaid piece has been fine. So why don't we go to the next slide, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So the Oregon Health Policy Board was asked specifically by Representative Greenlick to really take some time for the board to sort out where we want to take CCOs in this next stage. So contracts end in December of 2018, and he specifically wanted to be informed about where are opportunities to accelerate change, improve what we have in place. We had the statute laid out at a fairly high level that provided a lot of flexibility, and he wanted the board to come back and inform the legislature along with the governor about where are some opportunities for improvement. So Zeke Smith, who chaired the policy board, asked for a subcommittee to work with him, and that included Brenda Johnson, who actually is a director of La Clinica down in Medford, and Dr. Joe Robertson, who is president of OHSU, to join him to go out and listen to the communities. And his specific interest was to hear from those who were receiving care and delivering care, so consumers and advocates and service delivery providers, about how the their CCO experience was working. So they visited six areas. OHA staff, my staff, supported this effort. So we would go out, I think I mentioned in a previous discussion, to make sure that the sites that the listening sessions were going to be held at were accessible, that we had all the interpretation set up for different language speaking, for individuals who were deaf and needed translation. So we had all those things. That was our job, and it was really to be a support to those board members so that they could engage with the public. And they visited six areas of the state and had very good conversations. And it was very interesting because they would go, I think Bend was the first place they went to. And, you know, every CCO has its own characteristic, but they were trying to get to certain themes. And they wanted to make sure to understand how governance was working, whether individuals felt represented in the governance structure of the CCOs. They wanted to get after transparency, accountability, that engagement. They wanted to hear from the advisory committees of CCOs, whether they had a voice in the say of how things were working. They wanted to hear about how well integration was working. That was with regard to both behavioral health and oral health. And they took all that information in. Our staff was there taking notes and recording and compiling all that information. Staff launched a survey. And then the board took in that information and had conversations at its board members about where they wanted to focus. And the result of that effort resulted in recommendations that came to the healthcare committees and also were sent to the governor's office to inform their consideration of possible statute changes that would inform the next round of CCO contracting. Okay.
So it was listening. It was listening at the upper end rather than at the lower end.
Yes, that's correct.
Representative Buehler.
Question about methodology of the survey, because the event in Bend was pretty much stakeholders showed up. There wasn't a whole lot of users or patients that showed up. So I'm glad there was a survey. Was the survey, though, self-selected, or was it a random survey of Medicaid patients?
Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, and members of the committee, we have the detailed information about who participated in the survey. The survey was primarily launched to provide another avenue for input for individuals who couldn't attend the listening sessions in person. And I would say the diversity of response was a little greater in the survey, to your point. When you're doing listening sessions, even though you try to time them around people's schedules, you know that you can't attract as many people. But it was fairly, we had probably a greater level of participation in the survey from primary care providers and other service providers. That is also true for actual consumers, those members of the Oregon Health Plan. So
the survey was self-selected, though. They opted in to...
That's exactly right. Yeah.
I have a real problem with... I don't think that tells you much. I really don't. I encourage you, and I see this at all levels of mm-hmm. government, of the... you know, of these opt-in type surveys. Mm-hmm. They're not scientific. They're usually people who have some other stake in what's going on. I don't think it gives you useful information. I encourage you to reach out in a random way and mm-hmm. with some rigor to consumers and citizens.
Right.
I think it leads us down very, very odd directions.
Great. Co-chairs, Representative Buehler, members of the committee. It was one avenue, and it was one piece of information to inform the discussion. We also, as you know, we do a lot of other surveys. We do a client satisfaction survey on an annual basis. We provided that information. We also did, we do a financial analysis. We provided the board with that information. And we also did receive other letters from both CCOs and other interested parties that wanted to be on record about what they wanted to have the board advised to. So I think we used both qualitative and quantitative information to inform the discussion. We also went to our Oregon Health Authority staff that runs some of these programs and say, what are your thoughts in terms of things that don't seem to be working? Where are opportunities for changes? So it was probably not just one tool, but many tools that we used to inform it. I would also say that it does seem to be the Oregon way that stakeholder engagement and process is really a valued part of what we do to provide forums for people to come and talk to us. And I agree with you that you won't always get everybody's voice at all those kind of listening sessions. So,
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward.
So just to clarify, how do people find out about the survey?
So the Oregon Health Authority worked with the Regional Health Equity Coalitions, and they also worked with the CCO's advisory councils to help get the word out. We did our website, but we also worked with our innovator agents and others to try to spread it in the local communities.
So follow up if I could, Mr. Chair. So, to be clear, it was self-selected, but everybody, all CCO members, all OHP members, had the opportunity to participate, assuming they were given notice by their own CCO or their innovative, the regional folks. So, I agree with Representative Beeler's concerns. I'm not disagreeing with him per se, but it's in essence no different than if you'd done a random selection and only had a 30% response rate, which we know often happens with some of these. And I guess the question I would ask is, do you have any sense of whether the respondents are representative of the demographics of the OHP population? Because if they are, then that says something different than if they're not, right? Like if you get more adults and living in the urban areas and Caucasian than you do rural folks or people of color or whatever, that's a different story, proportionate, then it's a problem. Right. But if it's not, if it turned out to be proportionate, then we're less apprehensive.
Thank you, co-chair and members of the committee. I think we always struggle with getting the diversity that we want to get in terms of, our responses. Do they match up with the racial and ethnic composition of our membership? I would say for the most part, no. And that's something that we are continuing to work on. It's a priority. But I would say at this point in time, I think we're still falling short in that area.
Representative Beeler.
Yeah, don't get my comments wrong. I think listening tours and providing access for people who are, have passionate about a topic or an area is a good thing. But I do think there needs to be more rigor in listening to those who rarely get heard. And I don't think we do a very good job of that in Oregon at all levels. And I think there's a lot of frustration out there. And these people, have very little bandwidth to show up at a meeting in Bend in the middle of the afternoon. And it's just a little bit of effort to reach out to them to get their perspective in a rigorous way that makes sure you match up the demographics of the people you serve, I think, would be very important to do.
Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you. I'm trying to think. I think I already mentioned the Oregon's performance plan. That is a very aspirational plan. It is a 3-year plan. There are very specific metrics that Oregon has agreed to pursue, and this is something that we actually are Similar to as if we had a consent decree with the federal government, we have a consultant that has been assigned to us, and she's reviewing all the data that we produce. So I'll just give you an example. One of the things that is expected in this plan is we increase the number of assertive act treatment providers, and we have a baseline, and every year we have to increase that, and it depends, you know, it varies depending on the particular area. That consultant looks at our data, drills down to the data, makes sure that she's comfortable and validates that data, and she's also, her role is intended to help us really make improvement. We provide that data to the federal government on a annual basis. Let's see what else. I think we can flip. We can go ahead. You heard quite a bit from Jim Rickards, the Health Evidence Review Commission, and Oregon's prioritized list. I guess I just want to let the newer members of the committee know that this is absolutely unique. No other state Medicaid program in the country has a prioritized list. This prioritized list was stood up by Governor Kitzhaber in the mid-1990s, and it... It really drives Oregon to focus on what works so that when we are facing tough times, that we've got a scientifically informed list of benefit priorities so that we're not in the position of cutting things that work and keeping things that maybe the evidence isn't there for. I've mentioned the primary care payment reform, multi-stakeholder collaborative. I just want to say that I think this was a fantastic effort. There were recommendations that came out of this group. They included commercial health plan at that table with us, along with CCOs, along with the federally qualified health centers and primary care providers. And I think that they came to an agreement over recommendations that were very aspirational. Those recommendations were provided to both of the healthcare committees. So I'm hoping that, and I think they are too, that that'll inform legislation to really continue to push us toward a more sustainable way of paying for primary care. And directing payments not only in a greater amount, but also using a value-based payment reform model, so moving away from that fee-for-service reimbursement methodology.
Representative Buehler.
I'm glad to hear that, because I hear a lot of criticism about your rate-setting methodology, that it's a big barrier to actually going to a value-based payment system.
Right.
Do you care to respond to those criticisms?
Co-chairs, I think what we would like to do in the Oregon Health Authority is do everything that we can to support the movement toward value-based reform. And we've done that to a degree through some technical assistance providers. There's a national consultant, Michael Bailett, that we've used for some time, and we have actually acquired him through a state innovation grant and made his services available to CCOs to work through that process. I think we are, you know, candidly, and I'm not an expert in this area, in a little bit of a tension with the world that is based on fee-for-service and moving into value-based reform, and with, you know, the CMS's regulations around actuarial soundness and counting widgets. But I think we are on a path to progress in that area, and Oregon appears to be in one of the top states in the country that is really making some headway. But we have a long way to go yet, and we are still in that tension where you've got one foot in fee-for-service world and one foot in value-based payment world. When we talked about this in the CCO listening tours, I think a lot of people don't really understand what that means, and you know, what is a value-based payment versus a fee-for-service. So we have some ways to go, but we're committed to working on that. And I think that's where a lot of our attention needs to be focused in this next couple of years.
Yeah. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Co-Chair Rayfield. Do you have a feel for, we're very aware of this push and take, and do you have a feel for, is that 5%, 95%, or is it, where would you put it, where we're at now, if we're looking to move forward, so we can kind of judge what success is for those that
I'm going to look to Lori, because I know that she probably has a better percentage of where we are than I do in terms of the payments that CCOs make out in value-based payments versus fee-for-service.
Representative Hayden, co-chairs, members of the committee, we looked in about 2015, it was about 70% of payments were still fee-for-service. The rest are what we call subcapitation, so the CCOs then pay a capitation to their providers. Since 2015, though, during the years of 2015, 2016, so, or 2016, 2017, we've seen much more. I don't have that quantified. We can take a look and see from our financial reports from the our finance team. But we know that the Transformation Center has a couple of TA providers who are working actively with CCOs. And we know that in meeting with the CCOs on their rate development, that meant that the whole idea around value-based payment and incentive payments for providers has been growing.
Quick question. And when you look at that 70-30 split or whatever it is, do you look at just the first tier of contracting, meaning from you got the OHA to the CCO, and then the CCO, again, subcontracts to Group X, right? Mm-hmm. Are you looking beyond that to what does Group X or what does this entity then do with that subcap? Are they paying their providers when you actually get down to the physician level or the mental health provider or oral health provider? What are they doing in that? Does it arc back up? I mean, it kind of looks like, okay, we got a value base, but then when the actual rubber hits the road, if you will, where are we at on that?
Representative Hayden and members of the committee, we in our current financial reporting, we do not look beyond. So to your point, we may pay a capitation or a global budget to the CCOs. They may, let's say a CCO makes an arrangement with a provider group and pays capitation. We do not necessarily look at what that provider group then pays some other downstream providers. I think we've had some discussions about doing some expanded reporting in that area. It's administratively burdensome, as you can imagine, to have the downstream providers report out to CCOs and then up to us. So we do just look at the first tier, I guess.
Representative Bueller.
Think about how the best way to phrase this. Some CCOs have voluntarily invested a certain amount of their margin in the social, influencing the social determinants of health. What's OHA's position to make that a mandate for all CCOs to invest a certain part of their margin to impact the social determinants of health?
I can talk about that a little bit. Representative Bueller and members of the committee, we do not have a target right now to set a mandate for that. We believe that by implementing some incentives to promote margin or savings being invested into health-related services, that we will see that expand. So I talked about it yesterday a little bit, but if a CCO is investing their savings back into the community, number one, those investment dollars now will be counted as medical expenses for their medical loss ratio. And then the second piece is we will be counting those services when we develop the rate, and they'll get credit for those in a what we're calling a CCO specific administration rate. So we think that by those two mechanisms that we'll be able to provide incentives for CCOs. We did not in our waiver, we haven't had discussions of requiring CCOs to invest. However, we do have in the waiver, we did say that we are going to promote value-based payment, and there may be we are going to be having discussions with CCOs here over the next couple of months about what would be a reasonable, proportion to require CCOs to enter into value-based payments with their providers.
please. The architects of this whole CCO and Healthcare Transformation Center, mm-hmm. Winters outlined, you know, many of them aren't here, unfortunately, anymore. And I detect a lack of a long-term vision for where the CCO concept is going. Can you provide that to me? What if you had a letter from the future 5-6 years from now, what would CCOs, how would you describe what they look like to me?
I'll take one. I'll take a whack at this. Co-chairs, members of the committee. I think it is one of those things that we're pressing for. So I'm kind of a pragmatic person, right? So
I like that.
I love the aspirational notion of the CCO. I think that we have a stellar policy framework. I think Senator Steiner Hayward asked Lori the other day, do you think we've done it? No, we're not there yet. We have a long way to go, especially with respect to behavioral health and oral health. I also think that, and this is something the committee has heard a lot about, is really the ideal notion was this single global budget that, you know, you would have the flexibility to pay for whatever you needed to do. We're not quite there yet, and we're not there because CMS isn't quite ready to let that go. We're continuing to press on that. We're continuing to look for opportunities for that. And then I just candidly think... probably if the political climate hadn't changed and the budget wasn't what it was, that it felt like there was a lot of momentum about social determinants of health and really understanding that there are some factors that impact people's health that are beyond their access to medical care. And this is that visionary piece. It really is the connection to what are we doing for working with stable housing? How can we use our Medicaid dollars and work with our housing partners, and I think we can do this, and we should do this because some of it's relationship building. Money would be helpful to help in addition to it, but I'm really stretching beyond just this medical view of the world and not understanding that those housing impacts, the educational impacts, the food insecurity impacts, and other population health factors need to be part of a regular discussion instead of a separate conversation. So, Lori?
Yeah, no, Representative Bueller, members of the committee, that's exactly right. And if you look at the goals, there are four main goals that we laid out in the waiver, and Leslie really hit them. One is to continue the integration of behavioral, physical, and oral health services that we know we made strides. We have more to go. The second is to focus on social determinants of health. The third is around payment and really promoting health-related investments in health-related services because we hope those investments improve social determinants, and then expanding the model. And so that's, you know, we see some of the models where the community has come together with the CCO to improve health and have some say in terms of what those health-related services are going to be to benefit the community. We see we'd like to promote that type of community thinking, and really it goes to the idea that CCOs were community-based in the first place.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks. So I'm going to pivot down. Next slide. We talk a lot about primary care. I think we focus a lot here. It's a good focus to have. We were really thrilled by a recent study that Portland State produced that really showed that Oregon's model of a patient-centered primary care works. I think Senator Winters raised this question on another topic earlier, is what's our return on investment? We have to be really smarter about where to put our dollars and where it makes the difference. And this study showed that
putting our dollars into patient-centered primary care and investing a focus in this area works, and showed a $240 million savings over 3 years. What's exciting is that that they also tracked the maturity of that model itself. So it's a team-based model that is not just limited to services that are face-to-face, and showed that as clinics matured in their use of the model, the savings increased over time. So, you know, we're really pleased by the fact that we have almost 660 primary patient-centered primary care clinics throughout Oregon that are doing this important work, and the results are really positive here. So we just need to continue that momentum. The other piece on this slide is, you know, Dr. Rickard's favorite topic, and it's about drug costs. And really, there's a lot of things. It's a very complex area. I think this just shows, you know, those specialty drug costs, the price, I would say, have just been shooting through the roof. And this is not not solely a Medicaid program. It's a PEMINOA program. It's a commercial health problem, and it's also a Medicare problem. So it is something that, you know, we can use a lot of our own state tactics and strategies, but there has to be a national conversation about this, too, because a part of the reason why we're where we are today is because of federal regulations that have permitted pharmaceutical companies from pretty much pricing their drugs where they want to. There is always market that plays into driving some costs down, but we will continue to work in this area. And I think that's really all this slide really says. This is just threw in a key performance metric. It is one of the areas that we provide incentives to the CCOs to make sure they hit. They've been doing a stellar job. I think they focused on this from the very outset when they launched. So we continue to track it, and we'll continue to support it. I want to move to the Health Analytics Office. I'm really...
and actually, at this point, I think this would be a good place to stop and start on Monday, if that works for you.
Sure.
Unless you're just ramped up and want to go through this slide.
I can ramp up and go through this slide.
Well, you didn't expect that. No, I was actually wanting you to say no. I would rather go over this on Monday.
That's fine.
At least give us a little extra
time.
Mr.
Chair, can I say one thing really quickly?
Yeah.
I'm going to put my primary care doctor hat on and say, for those of you who don't have a bullet of experience in it, the stuff that Dr. Clemens just talked to us about the patient-centered primary care homes, has really been transformative in the delivery of the kinds of care that we want to give patients. It's the reason we're keeping people out of emergency departments. It's the reason we're preventing hospitalization bounce backs. It's the reason that, what do we call them, ambulatories, we're preventing ambulatory sensitive hospitalizations. It's the reason that people with mental health problems are more stable because they're getting the kinds of coordinated wraparound services that they need. And provider satisfaction is going up. And we talk about triple aim, but in fact, we should probably talk about quadruple aim and that provider satisfaction. And that's not just doctors, it's nurses and MAs and front office staff. We know that when there's burnout among these folks, the quality of care goes down because people rush stuff, they don't pay attention to the details, they're not as sensitive to the tenor of the conversations they're having with patients. And so this program is truly, I mean, I've been a physician for 30 years, and I will tell you that this is by far the most exciting thing, and it's why I went into primary care medicine, and it's really totally changed how our clinics practice and what we're able to provide for our patients. It's damned exciting. Excuse my language. I probably shouldn't say that on the podium, but it really is.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much. We'll see you on Monday.
Okay.
We'll go ahead and adjourn the meeting.